This is Jeff Brown, China Rising Radio Sinoland in Shenzhen, just south of the Tropic of Cancer. And I am so honored today to have on the air Mr. Paul Edwards. How are you doing today, Paul?
I'm good. I'm pretty good, actually. A little bit flummoxed by the technology, but that's okay.
Paul, it's thanks to Patrice Granville that I learned about you and your work when he posted on the Greenville Post your recent article about the grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park. And as usual, I will include all the links that I in our interview article, and so that everybody can follow up on these. I reached out to you, and you kindly agreed to be on my show. Paul is a writer and filmmaker based in Montana, United States of America. I will include his email. You know, for me, that's kind of a litmus test. If someone's willing to, you know, publish their email, they're willing to reach out to people and talk to them, and I really appreciate that. And he also has a video channel called Class War Films, and I've watched three of his movies, and they're really excellent. And last year, the Greenville Post announced your channel to its fans, and they posted you. And unfortunately, at that point, I missed it. And I just caught the one about the grizzlies. You have also written for Counterpunch, which I will link. And you get on Information Clearinghouse, which I will link. So thank you for being on the show, Paul.
Great. Well, thank you, Jeff. I'm glad to be here. You know,
Paul, please tell us about yourself as much as you'd like. You know, your past and present, your generation growing up and your professional life. People would obviously be curious to know something about you.
Sure. I got to make it somewhat abbreviated because it's kind of long and detailed, and I'm old. So it's been a lot of years. Anyway, I was born in the Middle West. My dad worked with the Red Cross, and during the days of the London Blitz, when I was just a baby, I actually was born the same week that Hitler invaded Poland.
Wow!
And which is kind of interesting in itself, but Dad later morphed into the United Nations, and so we lived all over the world, really. I mean, in a lot of different countries. As a kid growing up, we were for a time in Europe, beginning in actually my first, I flew into Tempelhof Airport when I was about 6 years old, when it was still, bomb cratered, and everything in Berlin was blown to hell and sideways, and it was quite an impression for a kid. And we went to Prague. Dad was a mission chief there for International Refugee Organization. He later went to an outfit called UNRWA, which was United Nations Relief, and they dealt basically with displaced persons from World War II. In any case, spent a few years over there, so I had no real sort of sense of a permanent American home early on. And then Dad got crossways with the establishment and McCarthy during the McCarthy hysteria.
Oh,
was
really?
Accused of being a communist.
Oh, yeah, really?
He had helped people get out of from behind the Russian thing that was happening in Central Europe. They were, the Russians, when they came in, the communist regime, when they came in, their worst enemies were liberals and socialists. I mean, they hated them worse than the devil hates holy water. And so they were pushing them out of windows and machine gunning them and beating the shit out of them in the streets. And Dad helped a bunch of people escape from Prague that he'd known, and he got caught at it. But he was using our passports, mother's and mine, as well as his own, to get these people out because they were going to be killed. In any case, he got fired, and then shortly after that, he was accused, ironically, of all things, of being a communist. if you can get the irony in that, right?
Yeah,
so
he's
rescuing people from under the Soviet regime, and McCarthy calls him a communist. But it worked. He got his security clearance pulled. He got fired. We were out in the bushes for about 7 years before he got it back. And in that period of time, I went through 11 schools in 12 years and finished up in high school in Virginia. In four different countries.
Oh my God!
In high school, I was not a very good homeboy. I got an early case of the rebellions in many ways, and so I would leave home in the summer and hitchhike out west and and try to get work and doing anything. You know, as a kid, 15, 16, 17, and I would take whatever work I could get. And that's what got me through Montana the first time.
Okay.
When I saw, you know, the Bitterroots and the Rockies, and I never forgot it. Well, I never got a job there either. I would always have to go somewhere and work in the wheat fields or the bean fields or pitching peas or hay or something, because I just couldn't hook on in Montana to anything that would pay a wage. So I would end up in Washington or Oregon or Idaho or somewhere else. But I remembered Montana. So anyway, cutting it a little bit closer to short, I went to Princeton on a scholarship.
Oh, wow.
Was there for a while at the same time that that Fidel and his boys landed at Playa Giron and went into the mountains. And I got very interested in that. And I kind of spent more time looking into that than I did at some of my regular student stuff. And by that time I was very pissed about what had happened to Dad, you know. And so I was drinking and doping and screwing around and breaking rules. And eventually I got kicked out and left. And after that I did a lot of wander years, some of it Southeast Asia, some of it in Europe, some of it in Latin America, just kicking around, you know, just doing what I could do and trying to find out about things. And I was at one time an iron worker in Alaska. At another time I worked on a Thai freighter going around the world. I worked in a circus for an animal trainer for a while, which was kind of a bizarre piece of work, going on the road with the big semis with the animals and various other kinds of stuff, including almost really kind of backed into a couple of movie gigs that I got as a young kid, my 20s, early 20s. A picture with Jeff Chandler called Merrill's Marauders. It was done in the Philippines, and another one, Jeff Hunter, called No Man Is an Island, from the John Dunn poem. And I liked the acting, I liked the money, but I didn't like the routine. And again, you know, I didn't fit in well with these kinds of things. So I kicked around for a while, then I went back to sea for a while, and then along the way I took the law boards to see if I was going to go to law school, and I killed the boards and did very well, but I thought that, I really don't want to do this. I don't want to be a lawyer. What's a lawyer do, you know? So I ended up hooking on with an NGO in Costa Rica, which then eventually sent me to Vietnam, and I was in the I Corps area at Vietnam and as a field rep during the whole thing leading up to the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
And while I was there, I got interested in the movie making aspect, not acting, but in making a little movie to say something about that pathetic business. And I did. I made a little movie. I went to Hong Kong, bought some stuff with some money I had managed to hustle, and an Agra recorder and 16mm Bolex and stuff. I put together a Vietnamese crew and cast and did a little movie in Vietnam. By that time, I was persona non grata with the establishment over there. It was such an unbelievable bullshit thing, like so much of what's going on today, where, you know, it's all about, you know, if you, you know, nail their asses, their hearts and minds will follow, kind of thing. But it doesn't work. So I got at cross purposes with my particular outfit and got fired and left there and came back with my movie and went to New York and finished it. Got George C. Scott to narrate do the narration in it.
Oh, wow.
The whole story. But yeah, that was a total fluke, facilitated by an old actor friend of mine, a guy who was 40 years older than I, who we'd been buddies when I had done a couple of movies. And in any case, I almost sold it to CBS, but it was right at the time when the Pentagon Papers were kicking up the gravel, and they backed out of the deal, so I never sold it. I got hired, oddly enough, on the basis of having written a Western screenplay while I was trying to promote my movie. I got hired by Gunsmoke, and then I went to work in Hollywood, and I worked 25 years in the business.
Oh, really?
In television and movies. Mainly my, you know, the work that I got done was, a lot of it was in top 10 series, you know, Gunsmoke included, and then I did a lot. I did about 40 movies projects, of which only four or five got made, and they were the worst of my stuff, most mainly. You know, the most kind of cheesy and commercial, the good stuff that I did. I could not get it done. So that's pretty much the story. I worked. I had a, you know, a strong career in Hollywood for 25 years, and they finally petered out is when I got to be an old dude. Well, they got no much use for that anymore. So, you know, and the business changed a lot. It just became very corporate as opposed to what it was when I went into it in the 60s, you know, in the late 60s. And that's kind of the tale. It's been a rather, you know,
you should write a
bizarre trip.
You should write a book, Paul.
Well, I'm working a little bit on that, but I have trouble. You know, I never was a very good self-promoter, and I get bogged down in stuff by saying, you know, who really is going to give a shit about you? You're not Henry Kissinger, you know, so, who's going to buy this, you know? So I don't know. We'll see.
You haven't killed millions of people, so.
No, I haven't. The idea of even one kind of repulsed me. You know, I've seen enough of it. Seen enough blood on the streets to know that this is not fun.
Is your Vietnam movie, is that on YouTube?
It is. I have it, but I have not put it on the site for the reason that, what is a good reason? The reason is that it's, you know, it was shot in just before Tet in 67. And that's a long time ago, and it's like another lifetime.
Yeah.
I haven't tried to do anything with it for quite a while.
Okay.
Although it's remarkably germane to a lot of what's going on in Iraq and has gone on in Libya and Syria and all of this stupid, bloodthirsty, asinine, murderous stuff that's going on with it, killing ignorant people for no reason. It resonates. So maybe one day.
Well,
I haven't put it on our site, though.
During that 25-year career in Hollywood, Paul, tell us about your arc of awareness, you know, that what you were taught in school, those 11 schools in 12 years.
Yeah.
And that the U.S. media, you know, is what I call the big lie propaganda machine. You know, was it a slow evolution for you, or did you have like a particular experience, or was there like a series of happenings that caused you to have an epiphany? Please share this with our listeners out there, because a lot of people get a lot of inspiration. They want to try to break out and be more outspoken and more active, and it really helps to hear other people's stories.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of help in my conversion, as it were, and that help came from, I didn't really get it when I was 10 or, you know, maybe 12, but what happened to my dad was that he was a, he was a preacher's kid who had been raised poor, who'd been on the bum in the Depression, who'd been taken off the freight trains and put in a CCC camp, and became the head of it, the young head of it, and then moved into the National Youth Administration under Roosevelt. And this was a hardcore, if you can call him that, American, decent American liberal.
Yeah.
He was never a liberal. He was a liberal to the core. He believed that government existed to help people because he had seen goddamn well that it helped him. You know, it did. Dad said it was Roosevelt's work creations that kept him from being a criminal. And I think he meant it. In other words, you know, he believed that government ought to support in its efforts, not with money, but support in its efforts the working, struggling, people who actually are who do things and make things and want to work. And so when I saw him, who was as decent a man as I ever knew, sabotaged by his own government for reasons which were entirely dishonest and contrived, by the time I'm 13 and 14, I was pretty bitter about it. And I went, as a kid, I went to the Army McCarthy hearings. We lived outside Washington, D.C. then. And I went to the Army McCarthy hearings, and I was there under the... I got into the rooms. I knew how to do this stuff. You know, my cousin and I was kind of a thug. We used to sneak into everything, theaters and plays and you know, warehouses, whatever, when we were kids. And we ran the streets. My mother was sick, and there was no... My dad was working, working in the bar in those days when he was out of... You know, he'd lost his security clearance. He had no way to make a living but to just scratch. And so we knew how to get into... We knew the Capitol, my cousin Ronnie and I, and we knew how to ride the little train down underneath the Senate office buildings and how to get passes and how to see senators. And it was kind of like... We put it in the same category as sneaking into the Washington Senators ball games. You know, it was kind of the same kind of deal. So I was in the room when the day that Joseph Welch cut McCarthy's balls off and said, "At long last, Senator, at long last, have you no decency, sir?"
Yeah, I remember that. I remember reading about that. Yeah.
Was the end for McCarthy. He looked so bad, and he had been such an evil son of a bitch that people watched that on television, and it within a matter of, literally within a matter of months, McCarthy was dead from alcoholism.
Yeah, he was.
And the rest of it. Anyway, that's how I got originally early converted, and it took, and it never has left me. Somebody once said, it might have been Burke that once said that, you know, I never dared be a radical when I was young for fear that I'd be a conservative when I was old. But I didn't have that fear. I was a radical when I was young, and I'm just as radical as hell to this day, and I expect to die that way. That was my art.
Hey, Paul, for your... I watched three of your films, and I really enjoyed them. You have a YouTube channel called Class War Films, and for the fans out there, I will put the link there. And do you work solo or do you work with others? You know, I love the narrator's voice. Your movies have this kind of... And now that I've heard your story, and now I can maybe see the genesis. You know, they have this kind of retro 1950s, you know, cops and robbers TV feel to it. I mean, are you doing that all on your own, or do you work with somebody?
Yeah, no, the narration is mine. The writing is mine. The narration is mine. I have a very close friend from years and years ago. Went to some graduate classes at UCLA at one point with him, and we became friends. Lanny Kotler, who is an equal partner in Class War Films, but he's much more technically savvy and adept, and is way better at that sort of stuff than I am. So we work together and complement each other, and I do the narration. I do the...
Now that I've heard your voice for the first time, you know, and I know it's you, I can see that is your voice in your voiceover, your narrative. So,
little touch of noir there, maybe.
Anyway, great stuff, and I will encourage everybody to watch your videos. So Paul, thanks for telling us about your Class War Films and how they're done. Please tell us about the grizzly bears and Yellowstone and why their story resonates with you.
Well, the grizzly is not, of course, for me, it's not only Yellowstone. I was got a ranch up on the edge of the Bob Marshall Wilderness in Montana, which is about equidistant, actually, from Yellowstone and Glacier Park. And, you know, for me, Glacier is kind of more my home park than Yellowstone, although I've been and done Yellowstone repeatedly in various ways, from hiking to all of the, you know, the sites and et cetera. But the thing with the bear with me was when we bought the ranch on the front, which is right at the edge of the Bob Marshall Wilderness, I think I had told you that I did a lot of mountaineering in California and elsewhere in the world, and climbing in Yosemite and so on. And so the Bob Marshall to me was like, you know, being that close to it was, that's the reason I bought the ranch there, because I love the wilderness, I love the outback. And Doug Peacock, who's an old ex, you may know of him, he was a friend of Ed Abbey, who did Solitaire and Monkey Ranch Gang. Anyway, Doug was a friend, and he was a grizzly expert who I'd had contact with and got some information from. And when I bought the ranch, I began to go into the Bob regularly, and I had, over a period of, you know, 15, 20 years, I had a lot of encounters with grizzly, most of them very benign, most of them pretty distant, a couple of bluff charges, but nothing serious. I always carried bear spray, because bear spray is the answer, period. I mean, a lot of things.
I'll write that down.
No, that's for sure. It really, really works. I mean, I know it from experience. A lot of goofy hunters, you know, they're out there for elk, and they're out there where it's pretty hairy and where the grizzly lives, and then if they get jumped or if they spook a grizzly and it charges, they use heavy weaponry on it, and you know, that's how grizzlies die, is with people in people conflicts. And grizzlies are a fabulous animal. They are apex predator. In my book, they should be preserved at any cost, whatever, because they are a magnificent animal, and if we run them to extinction, it will be this very sad commentary on what kind of a creature we are. Yeah. So anyway, I did a lot of stuff in the Bob, and I've seen a lot of things. I'm very identified with them and their plight, their shrinking habitat. I was involved in promoting the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, which is the one wilderness bill that gets it all for wild country, that connects corridors between the few existing large wilderness areas left in the West. And that's where the grizzly lives, and they are constantly under fire from the Fish, Wildlife, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, from the Department of the Interior, from sport hunters, from the Tibet NRA, and from, you know, anybody who thinks it's lots of fun to kill things.
That
it makes you a big man if you shoot something, you know, with a 30-06 at 150 yards, that somehow makes you more of a man than the thing you killed, which is, it just shows what a bunch of cretins the headhunters, the trophy hunters are. I got nothing against providing food for yourself if that's what you need to do. You know, that's under the heading of at least a kind of necessity. But as far as any trophy hunting or hunting in order to show that you dominate, you know, the big predators, that's for children and wank-offs and jerks. So I wrote this piece about the grizzly because the reason I wrote the piece was that sure as hell the Fish and Wildlife Service and the governments of the states of Idaho and Wyoming actually went on a campaign to delist the Yellowstone grizzly so that it could be hunted.
Unbelievable.
For, you know, expensive, they sell a lottery for
for
licenses, and you spend a lot of money, and if you win one, you get to kill an animal. I mean, and the grizzly are threatened and severely endangered, and particularly in the park, which is one of the few large wilderness areas left. And when I heard about it, I just went on the fight, you know, in terms of administratively, I bought it through the Alliance for the Wild Rockies. I'm vice president of that outfit, and we're about the toughest environmental organization in the United States today. But it wasn't enough. You know, people need to know what's going on. So I wrote the piece, and probably I'm talking too much about it, but I wrote a piece which I think laid out the insanity of wiping out the last great animals in the world. I mean, what are we thinking as a race?
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, want to kill off all the bees too, then you won't have any food.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just so insane to be doing this, Jeff, you know?
Yeah.
So that was it. And the piece could be read on, I think Patrice Greenville posted it again on his, if I'm not mistaken, on his website, and it's not CounterPunch.
That's how I found you. That's how I got introduced to you, and so I will put the link in our article for the interview. So yeah, it's really powerful and meaningful, and I really appreciate what you wrote.
That's great, because you know, the more people know about it, I mean, these things are very hard to. It's hard to defend anything that money wants. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If money wants it, money will get it. And unless you are ready to fight until you're bleeding from all orifices, you probably are not. You know, it's a tough son of a bitch to fight money, and money wants what they want.
Anyhow,
enough said on that. I'm glad I wrote the piece, and thank you for showing it around.
I get the impression that you have adopted a vegan diet. I mean, I don't know. I may be completely wrong, but that you've adopted a vegan diet. And if that's true, tell us about it and for how long and what inspired you to do so.
Well, I'm not a vegan. I'm not a lot of things that people can belong to or movements. I'm kind of a maverick. So what I have done is, knowing the cost, I mean, ecologically, of the massive meat business in the world. I'm not talking just about America, I'm talking worldwide.
Yeah.
And what kind of insane numbers are involved in, for example, in cutting down the rainforest in Brazil so you can fodder cattle on the grass.
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of ecological destruction is one element. And the other element is, the stupidity and the cruelty of the way that we run animals through feedlots
modern agriculture.
In prison. Yeah, agribusiness sucks, and it's shameless, and it's all about money. So those were two things that pushed. But then the other thing was, you know, when I came home from Vietnam years ago, I would go to the store and buy great big-ass pieces of meat and barbecue. I couldn't get enough meat for a number of years because there wasn't any in Asia. You know, I mean, you got very little those days. I ate meat like a predator for a long time, but I just, as I got older, I began to see that this is not a very, it's certainly not a healthy approach to eating. And, you know, as you taper off from your physical needs, it becomes easier to taper off on what you put into you, you know, to run. And I'm really into, at this point, a heavy vegetable and fruit and plant-based diet. I don't get me wrong, I don't eat no meat. I've always liked meat. I'm as much an omnivore as the next guy, but I eat much less of it.
Yeah.
And I consciously buy less of it.
Yeah, that's what my wife and I are doing.
Yeah, it's economically destructive, and it's bad for you. You don't need that animal stuff in your veins and arteries. So that's that. I enjoy the more richer diet, I think, from going toward fruit and vegetables and so on.
Yeah, after our daughter here in China, we were up in Beijing. She left. You know, she's 18 and growing, and you know, we felt like she needed her meat, and you know, she was actually anemic. She had several bouts of anemia, so you know, we were eating a lot of red meat. But once she left the house, three or four years ago, my wife and I, we have cut way, way back, and now we really don't. We just eat a very tiny bit here in the house, and then our mantra is, well, you know, when we can, we eat vegetables and we eat veggie meals. But when we're in a social situation, you know, with Chinese and stuff, we're not going to sit there and make a scene and, you know, refuse to eat it.
No.
It's offered to us. And so, but we have cut way, 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 way back. And so I think we're probably on the same, wavelength. Well, let's get back to some go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, that one of the good things about living in Asia, as you do, is that, you know, they just are not meat eaters in the same quantity, same portion that we are. You know, they don't, you don't get 16 ounce cuts of meat.
That's right.
And that's their diet is healthier in Japan and China, I think.
Absolutely.
By far the fact is. I had the pleasure of being in China 4 or 5 years ago. I was astonished by many, many things, which I don't need to tell you about. But one of the things I thought was, you know, that their way of eating is just way superior to the common way of eating in America.
Absolutely. Well, hey, listen, the midterm elections happened 2 days ago in the United States. Not that it matters, but what is your take on Donald Trump? You know, how do you compare him to Obama, Bush, Clinton, and his other predecessors? Do you think he's different? Do you think he's the same? Do you think his winning was planned by the elites, or was it a mistake? Is he for or against the deep state? It seems to me like he's doing more to unravel Western empire than any president except for Roosevelt. You know, and he made a number of anti-imperial promises during the campaign. What do you make of the guy? I just cannot figure him out.
Well, he is a wild hare for sure. He is. I think he's a coarse and shallow buffoon, and a public shame and a disgrace to the country. But the country itself is kind of a shame and a disgrace. Actually, look at your whole card. You know, we've been, and as regards him and his differences, he is so much more of a shallow, egotistical, carnival barker jerk in public than any previous president. But he's not, I say this sincerely, he is not any more of a liar and a phony than were Obama, who was one of the great disappointments in the history of our country. Who Obama, the thing that he had was finesse.
Yeah.
He had savoir vivre. He had the smoothness of high style and high education.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, he simply betrayed the country and its real interests of the people in every possible way.
And the world.
Because he promised all sorts of things while behaving in directly counter to his promises. Remember the speech he made in regarding the Arab world in Cairo, when he was so lauded for it, getting the Nobel Peace Prize, for God's sake, when the guy simply doubled down on everything that the idiot Bush did.
Yeah.
So the big difference between Trump and those other guys is stylistic. The secondary difference is that he is not and never has been a genuine or a factual representative of the deep state. He is counter the deep state in many ways, although the deep state has pushed him away from the few things that he said he might do that might have been useful, one of which was to cut back NATO, one of which was to cut back overseas expansion of wars, one of which was to have come to some kind of workable understanding with Russia and China. They don't want him to do that. The deep state is represented by people like Obama and Clinton, who have forwarded our program of destroying much of the world for predatory capitalism and for oil.
Yeah.
And so he's a wild card and a shame and an abysmal son of a bitch in many ways. It's a lot of it has to do with the fact that he's just got this punk sort of South Bronx
style.
And he can't help but be of the vulgarian that he is. I think he's a horror, but I think in one way he is exposing the dirty underwear of the deep state, and it pisses them off crazily. It makes them insanely furious that this guy is showing openly what they've hidden successfully for years behind sweet words and platitudes. So don't get me wrong, I think he's awful. I think he is a reprehensible wank who in any reasonable democracy would never been able to be nominated. But we don't have a reasonable democracy. We don't have a democracy at all.
Yeah.
What we have is a totalitarian imperialist state in a in an advanced state of decline, even though it's enormously powerful. So, and the election, you know, the election is, it's a push. It's a nothing. You know, the Democrats have a tiny margin in the House, which means nothing, except a bunch of useless investigations that'll go nowhere, much like the Mueller thing. And the Republicans, because of the two, you know, two persons per state, regardless of population, they have the upper house, which will neutralize anything that any of the naive Democrats who have any values will be trying to do. But basically, Democratic Party has no policy. They're not for anything. They're for the military-industrial-imperial complex, and they're for wars overseas, and they're for, you know, anything that supports militarism, whether it's for Israel or the oil companies or for the banks. But they have no policy that appeals to any human beings.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think he has done a great job. I mean, I think he's done a wonderful job of helping undo empire by exposing it and being so brash.
Yeah.
And basically by hanging the deep state's dirty laundry out, you know, for everybody to see.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but I'd rather have him in the White House than Hillary Clinton. I mean, she was a confirmed war criminal before she even ran for president.
She's the absolute apotheosis of the deep state. She was the deep state candidate, and that's why the party and the big powers are so offended and have been. The fact that she lost, that she was, in addition to being a criminal and a harpy, she was also a horrendous candidate.
Yeah.
It was a joke. You know, she was like the whole thing was for her was like a party in the Hamptons.
Yeah, you know? Marie Antoinette.
The white slacks cadre, you know.
Yeah.
The white wine and caviar set. You know?
Yeah.
It's insane. What?
Yes,
I'm with you.
And supposedly the Democrats are supposed to be for the working people. What a joke. Paul, besides grizzly bears and class war, and by the way, I'm going to put links to your articles. You really are a good writer, and I encourage you to write more. You're really hard hitting. I mean, people kind of blanch at my writing because I'm hard hitting. Man, you are like... You're like a what is that? You're like a cage fighter when you're writing. It's just and your films, your films are really, really, you're really. I mean, you just come out swinging and kicking and flailing and you're like a chainsaw or a buzzsaw or something. But I really enjoy your take no prisoners approach.
That's nasty work, but somebody's got to do it.
Besides grizzly bears and class war films, what other projects do you have in the works? Is there anything else that's inspiring you to do something else?
Well, you know, there's my entire focus is actually, now that I'm an old geezer, is just to try to shine the light on things which are so threatening to all life. And that are not being resisted, and that are not being effectively described and held in front of the public eye. You know, the climate change thing is gonna be unbelievable catastrophe.
Yeah.
And I plan to say some more about that. I think the death throes or the death grip that capitalism has on the world has got to be broken, and I am not about to tell you how, but it cannot last because it's so internally contradicting that it will slit its own throat with its greed and its insanity.
Yeah.
So those are my areas of focus. And then, you know, within that, there's all kinds of a range of things to talk about. So you don't run out of things to critique, that's for sure.
Hey, listen, before we sign out, and what I'll ask you to do is give it some thought and then send me a list. But Can you recommend, I mean, is there a book writer, a journalist, blogger, filmmakers, audiovisual artists that you'd like to recommend? And then I'll ask you to maybe type that out, and I'll put the list in the article and try to find the hyperlinks for them. But are there any book writers, journalists, filmmakers, or audiovisual artists that really impress you?
Yeah, mainly now because I'm much more focused. I mean, I worked in entertainment for a long time, and there are talented people who are writing prose. I'm not much of a person for reading novels and entertainment category stuff anymore, because I think we're really down to a critical point where what needs to be said is not fiction, which is sort of oblique. You know, when it's great, it's great. I mean, if there was a Victor Hugo nowadays, it should be. But you know, generally speaking, that's not what novels are. But there are still many journalists who are, and bloggers who are really strong. And among them, of course, is Chris Hedges, who is tremendous. John Pilcher, who's fabulous, who's a longtime guy. I met him in Vietnam when we were both kids years ago, and he's never been anything but terrific. The work that certain kinds of bloggers like Jeffrey St. Clair are doing with Counterpunch, and Tom Feely is doing with the Information Clearinghouse, are just absolutely invaluable in terms of getting information out there. There are strong movie makers, although much of movie making now, as you no doubt know, is in the hands of the corporations.
Yeah.
And they've taken it and jammed computer graphics into it to the point where it's all phony, and there's very little that's done that is really meaningful and moving in terms of the human condition. So I look for it, but I don't find it a lot. And so, you know, I'm pretty focused on people who I think are telling the truth about how the world is, such as, you know, Assange. I mean, was a phenomenal journalist that's been abandoned by his craft and his peers, and they're letting him crucify the poor bastard. And he said all he ever did was to tell the truth about what's going on, you know. And the boy in Russia, you know, who is so terrific, his name is slipping my mind right now, but you will know him. The intelligence kid that blew the whistle and then had to run for it. It's now in Moscow.
Oh, yeah. I'm having a brain break. Yeah, anyway. We're too old. And we're too old, Paul.
We are. You can tell by the way we talk. And then Chelsea Manning, who had the balls and the guts. You know,
Of course, she's
lost the balls, but that doesn't make her a lesser of a person. she had the cojones to blow the whistle on what was going on militarily. These are important people. These are really important. And you know how you can tell they're important? John Kiriakou from the CIA. You can tell they're important because they're being persecuted.
Yeah.
Ray McGovern, you know, from the veterans These are people who are telling the truth, and they're in, by and large, they're getting the crap beat out of for doing it in one way or another.
Yeah.
But that's who I'm with. That's what I'm about.
Well, I'll toot my horn before we sign out. John Pilger actually endorsed my China trilogy books, my three China trilogy books. Yep. He actually read them or endorsed them. So I was a real.
Hey, where can I get them?
We'll talk about that.
I'll tell you about it.
I wrote the China. I've written three books about China. So, listen. This has been a wonderful interview. I'd like to have you back on. I still think you should write a book. I think you should get a recorder and just start jabbering about your life from birth up to now. I think you have an amazing story to tell, and even if it never gets printed, if you could just put it down in a recording form, it would be a wonderful repository for someone who's led an amazing life. So thank you so much, Paul, for being on. Love having you.
Yeah, thank you.
And you are, again, I encourage everybody to go to Class War Films. I encourage everybody to go to the links that I will put in the article where Paul does his writing. And I also encourage everybody to go to ChinaRising.PuntoPress.com, my website, where you get sort of an Asian viewpoint. So thank you so much, Paul. And as soon as I get this up, I will send you the link, and you can blast it out to all the people in your circles, so that they can hear what we had to say.
Terrific, Jeff. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I'm serious. It's been a great time.
All right. Talk to you later, Paul.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.